I think if Jack had felt that he had to wait 8 years to run for the presidency, he would have used 4 of those years to be a powerful senator. But he had to make up his mind, which is a very important decision. What are you going to try to do? I had to do that in 1960, and I didn't quite do it.
Stand on the corner.
I'll never forget. Hitch
their pants up and do something. And finally, it became a habit. I used that one. Well, instead of saying hello to anybody, I'd say to Pat O'Brien, I'd say, "Well, Jerry, what do you hear? What do you say?" But every now and then, they had to find these little things that
was born very painfully. We couldn't come up with a name. And the head of our promotion and publicity, Bob Hatch, said, "How do you expect me to promote something with no name?" So finally, writers or anyone who wished were asked to submit ideas, and so there were about 50 titles were on a page, and we decided that the least objectionable one on the page was something called Sesame Street. I worried aloud, because we knew we were going to have an inner city.
He had the monopoly of the airwaves, and that it might do no harm if I got in on them too. So I had my secretary write a letter, to short one paragraph letter to Senator McCarthy, saying that I proposed to attack his procedures in the Senate that morning. And I took the letter into the hearing room. And the minute I came in through the door, the Krieg lights were turned on me, and voices from all around saying, "This way, this way, this way," and a path was opened up for me right through to the table where Senator McCarthy was sitting, and I delivered him the letter.
Sure, but the authentic story is that Morse is a very impatient man, and my brother-in-law, Bernie, said that he planted a tree in the morning, he expected it to give shade in the afternoon. And he bought this charming 18th century stone farmhouse set in the middle of a cornfield. It didn't have a tree or a bush on the place. And Morse, being very impatient, planted 2,000 fully grown pine trees. And his collaborator, George S. Kaufman, came over one day to look at the place and looked around and said, "Well, Morse, it's exactly what God would have done if he'd had the money."
Soon after establishing the Columbia University Oral History Research Office, Alan Nevins, in February of 1949, recorded an interview with New York banker and civic leader George McEnany, the very first undertaken by the office. Shortly afterwards, Nevins interviewed 91-year-old Charles C. Burlingham, whose recollection of New York City's streets after the draft riots of 1863 remains the very first memory in the collection. What follows are brief excerpts from each of these interviews.
This is an interview with Mr. George McEnany by Professor Alan Nevins in February 1949.
You spoke of LaGuardia with a certain twinge of doubt in your voice. What were your impressions of LaGuardia?
Well, he was a indomitable little man. I think he personally was fairly honest, although he made a good many personal appointments. But I didn't like him. But he turned up as a champion of the underdog and the low caste man. He put himself behind some of the movements in the transit, the discussion that were not fortunate. He was then president of the Board of Aldermen, I think.
This is an interview with Mr. Charles C. Burlingham by Professor Alan Nevins in February 1949.
All right, sir. Now, if you'll tell us about Mr. Cardozo.
When George Wickersham was Attorney General, and that was in Taft's time, so it must have been about the same period, between 4 and 8. George was an intimate friend of mine, and he asked me if I would seek Benjamin N. Cardozo and see whether he would accept an appointment as United States District Judge for the Southern District of New York. So I went to see him, and I
put it before him, and he said no, he couldn't possibly do it because he had two sisters to support, and the pay was very small, something like $5,000 or $6,000 then. So that ended the episode. Then in 1912, we formed a committee of independent citizens to elect a mayor. And then the Republicans were very anxious that William H. Wadhams, of an Albany family living in New York, should be nominated to the Supreme Court. Well, he was a second-rate man, and we had some political wisdom, and we thought we'd like to nominate you for the Supreme Court. So we cast about, and we lighted on one named Frank, and we were about to name him when I fell in with Henry Moskowitz, who was on the committee, and I told him the situation. Oh, he said, you haven't got the right kind of a Jew. Frank is a Felix Adler Jew, a modernist. You want to get a man who is a real Jew. I'll tell you the man, Cardozo. He is of the Portuguese synagogue. He didn't use the word, but he was of the Sephardic. So, I went to Cardozo and asked if he would accept the nomination. By this time, he had become quite notable as a referee appointed by judges in difficult cases. And he'd shown his great ability. And he consented. I feel quite sure from talks with him later that he didn't expect to be elected. But he was elected, and he always used to say that he was elected by the Italians in the Bronx.
Mario Savio was studying philosophy at the University of California when he joined the more than 1,000 students who answered the call to register black voters in Mississippi during the summer of 1964. In an interview conducted in 1985 by Brett Einen for a project on the student movement that now includes 85 interviews, Savio recalled an experience at a poll in rural Mississippi that would change his life forever.
But there is one event which happened in Mississippi, which touched me the most deeply and summed the experience up for me and changed my life. And it was an event like ones that many other people had. It was impossible to be in Mississippi that summer without something touching you. I mean, you'd have to be stoned. So everybody must have a thing. I would go around, the way we did it was, we'd go around usually in groups of two, you know, and so forth, to the different farmhouses. And we'd say, we'd introduce ourselves. We're the civil rights workers who are here for the summer. I introduce myself, and I'd say, I've come to ask you to come and register to vote. Mm-hmm. A lot of people weren't registered to vote. And the person, I'd usually ask to speak to, usually the man of the house, and it was very traditional families. And I'd say that's what I was here for. And he'd say, there's a kind of way they talked. I mean, you could miss some of the words. It's really a dialect. But explain to me how. Well, he couldn't do that. I mean, if I register to vote, I'll lose my job. They'll kick me off. They'll kick me off this land. How am I going to feed my kids? So forth. And I knew it was true. Mm-hmm. And so I would say something like, I know that's true. I know there is that danger, at least. I mean, it may not happen, but there is that danger. And also, because I won't be here after the summer, so I'm not going to be facing that danger. You have to face it yourself. But then I'd say, I don't know how I had the guts to say this, I swear. But I'd say, well, did your father vote? I said, no. Did his father vote? No. Do you want your children to vote? I don't know how I got the guts to say that. And very frequently, in response to that, the person would say, okay, where do I come? There was a feeling, see, in the air that this was the moment of change. This was, you know, it was happening. See, the winds of change were blowing. Here, the person coming to your door was, you know, an emissary from the change, even if he was white, all right? So then we'd arrange for there to be a time when we come and pick the people up. Now, you weren't allowed to help people fill out the forms. You'd have to go, say, to the courthouse. So we went to the courthouse, and you were not to help people fill out the forms. They have a form to fill out. There was the sheriff's wife, I remember, was in charge. But you were allowed to come and stand and watch. This was the law, said that someone could come and stand, the person would have to go forward himself. And so I remember on this particular day, I, and there was another white worker with me, another one of the volunteers. And we came with this farmer. We're talking about an old man. He may have been 60 or 70. And he had a hat, you know. He came, and he was a bit stooped. He came in, and we all went into the courthouse together, the three of us. And then he walked forward to the desk. And he took his hat off. And he just stood there. And then she started in her, what do you want, boy? Man, 60 or 70. We were just standing there. What do you want, boy? I want a reddish, man. It's part of the dialect. They said reddish. And they turned register into a two-syllable word, reddish. Get used to it. Want a reddish, man. But in a very small voice. What's that you say, boy? Want a reddish, man. What's reddish? What are you talking about, boy? And on and on and on. He never gave up. She finally had to give him the form. But she made him eat shit for it. I mean, she really treated him with such humility. She humiliated him. And she tried anyway. And I was watching. And that man's courage changed my life. Until then, I was still sort of an observer in a certain way. Less and less so, okay? But here's somebody who, because of something I had done, was maybe risking, you know, his family. Facing that kind of humiliation, he must have been afraid. I know I was afraid. And yet he stood his ground. And we used to sing, there were the songs, you know, there were the civil rights songs. You know, we'd sing about how we'll never turn back. Ain't gonna turn around. And that was the point at which it all came real for me. That is, that I'd chosen sides for the rest of my life.
Known for her exotic looks and demanding behavior on the set, Nita Naldi in 1922 starred opposite Rudolph Valentino in the silent screen potboiler Blood and Sand. Interviewed in 1959 by Joan and Robert Franklin for a project on the American popular arts that includes 163 interviews, Naldi described in wonderful detail how she won the role.
But how I really got the job is the most amazing story, because everybody wanted to work with Valentino. He had finished The Four Horsemen and The Sheik, and something else he did with Dorothy Dalton. Well, it seemed that a friend of my mother's called Maria Barrientos, a great Spanish opera singer, had an apartment on Riverside Drive and 80-some-odd Street, and she invited me to come and visit her for a supper party, so I did. And I came from Mr. Ziegfeld's, where I was working, And there I met Mr. Blaskowy Beniers, the writer, the man that wrote Blood and Sand. He'd written The Four Horsemen, he'd written The Cathedral, several books. And, of course, I was perfectly horrified when I met Mr. Blaskowy Beniers for the simple reason that I had read a book that he wrote called The Cathedral, which impressed me as being violently communistic. But we didn't use the word communist in those days. Well, it seems that Maria Barrientos had a huge dish of punch in the middle of her salon. And, of course, when I met Mr. Blaskowy Beniers, I said, well, you monster of iniquity, you sacrilegious lout, now that you're a success, I suppose you change your entire theories for expediency. You've made a fortune selling your thing to the movies. And my dear, the man got so excited trying to deny the fact that he was a communist or communistically inspired that he dropped his false teeth in the middle of my bosom. I had a very low-cut evening gown on. And Maria Barrientos, who knew me from the time I was 4 years old, reached down in my bosom, pulled the false teeth out, put them in the punch bowl, practically sterilized them, much to the edification of the rest of the guests, and stuck them back in Mr. Blaskowy Beniers' face. So then he screamed at me. He said, you are done your soul. You are a very evil and very wicked woman. So he decided that I would play the part of this horror, this sadistic demon. And nothing would ever change him. He wouldn't have anyone else do it. He said he would. Well, I kept saying to him all the time, how dare you insult me? This woman is a monster. She's a sex maniac. She's a sadist. She's a horror of the worst type. And he kept answering me back all the time that that would be his revenge. And it was. I never outlived it.
While special counsel for the NAACP, Thurgood Marshall won 29 of the 32 cases he argued before the United States Supreme Court, including Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, the landmark case that ended the constitutional sanctions for racial segregation. In this 1977 interview conducted by Ed Edwin, Marshall recounted how he learned of his appointment as the first African-American justice of the United States Supreme Court.
Did you think that President Johnson was serious when he said the Solicitor General would be really the end of the line?
Yeah. He said it at least two out of every three times I talked to him. At least that many times. And he convinced me, at least. As a matter of fact, I was at a party with him the night before he gave me the job. And he said it again. He said he had completely disarmed me, completely. And the morning when the appointment came through, Ramsey Clark, the Attorney General, called my secretary and said, is the judge in? She said, yes. Is there anybody with him? She said, no. She said, well, don't let anybody in there. I'm coming down to see him. She said, fine. So he came down the hall, came in, and we had pleasantries and all. And I said, well, what you up to, Ramsey? He said, what are you doing this morning? I said, well, at 11 o'clock or whatever time it was, I've got to go up to the White House on the executive side to talk to some students or something like that, some people. And he says, do you have a car? I said, look, Mrs. Lavery knows what she's doing. If I got an appointment, she's going to have a car ready for me. He said, well, you go up there at 10:45 instead of 11. Instead of going there, you go to the Oval Room. I said, what for, Ramsey? He said, I don't know. And that still ended up, I don't know. So I said, okay. I said, well, what, did he just walk on in there? And then he said, no. Well, there were several ways, three ways at least, you could get in there without being seen. And he told me, he said, you better take that number one way. I said, okay, though. So I went down, got in the car, and went this way, and this is a very nice route, because what you do, at a certain spot, you just get out the car, and you walk over, there's a guard standing there watching the line of people going in that morning session, you know, visitors, and he puts you in line, you know, and you go in line with all other people looking up to, you're all excited for the first time you've ever seen the building. And then when you get in the building, when you get to a certain door, there's a Secret Service man that will beckon to you, and you go in there. And then you go to the cabinet room, and Marv Watson said that the president's seen in a couple of minutes. I said, what's up, Marv? He said, I don't know. So eventually he said, go on in. I went in, and he was over there at the ticker tape machines. And I waited a little while, and I coughed, and he said, "Oh, hi, Thurgood. Sit down, sit down." So he chatted just a few minutes, and I didn't ask him what was on his mind. I let him stick, and all of a sudden he just looked at me and said, "You know something, Thurgood?" I said, "No, sir, what's that?" He said, "I'm going to put you on the Supreme Court." And I said, "Oh, yeah, 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 what did you say?" And he said, "That's it." I said, "Okay, sir." And he had the press out there waiting in the Rose Garden, and he carried me out and announced it, and then we came back in the Oval Room. And I said, "Mr. President, now look, they're going to get that on the wire in about a minute. Now, can I call my wife so she won't hear it?" He said, "You mean you haven't told Sissy yet?" I said, "No, I could have been with you all the time." So we called her, and I said, got her on the phone. I said, "Sissy, are you sitting down?" She said, "No." I said, "Well, you better sit down." And she did. And then I beckoned to the president. The president said, "Sissy, this is Lyndon Johnson." She said, "Yes, Mr. President." She said, "I just put your husband on the Supreme Court." And Sissy said, "I sure am glad I'm sitting down." Then he said, very interesting, he said, "I guess this is the end of our friendship." I said, "Yep, just about. And be no more of that." And I said, "Well, I'll tell you this, Mr. President." I said, "You know, Tom Clark and Harry Truman was close as anybody, but when that Steele case came up, Tom had to sock it to him." He said, "Well, you wouldn't do like that to me." I said, "No sooner than." He said, "Well, that's the way it went." And that's the way it was.
Interviews in the Oral History Research Office's collection come from many sources. In this 1971 interview, completed by Charles Higham and donated to the office by Time Life Books, Fred Astaire tells the story of the famous scene in the 1951 film Royal Wedding, in which he danced on the walls and ceiling.
"Well, there are so many complicated. I did a dance on the ceiling, which is very complicated in one picture."
"Yes, how was that achieved?"
"The whole room turned, this room, it was a room about this size, and the whole room turned like this, you see, and as it came down, I met it. The camera went with it, you see, the camera went and everything went with it. So as I stayed at the bottom doing whatever I did and I met this wall as it came to me, when they finally set it on the lower line of the picture, it looked as if I was climbing the wall. And there I was, sticking out like this on the side of the wall. And then I got to the ceiling, I'm upside down. The complications of that were that things had to be lashed down. And as they tried it the first time, it was like a big iron lung that was built for this thing. It was very, took quite a while to do. And the turning of it worked by electricity. A fellow pushed buttons and he knew exactly when I'd be there. And then he'd turn it when I wanted to go to the top and look as if I was getting to the top. Do you understand what I'm saying? It was one of the things I really liked best of all the solos that I did. And it worked out because I dreamt it up one night thinking about how this could be, and then I tried to get it in a picture and it never fit into any picture for a couple of years, and Arthur Freed, who was the producer, this was at Metro, liked the idea so much, finally we found a place for it, which was in Royal Wedding, you know.
I'm surprised it didn't bring on an attack of vertigo.
Well, it's a funny feeling to be if this room is to turn around here now, and all of this is up there and that's down here, it's a very funny feeling. I can tell you that. You see, you're fighting the laws of gravity all the time, and to look as if you're really going, there's a tendency for you to look a little unnatural. I had to work on that, to just look as if I was splitting up. You see.
First time round, it was hard, was it?
Oh, I worked on it till about 3 weeks before we shot it. Oh, yeah. But it was worth it.
Continuing its documentation of the history of New York City politics, the Oral History Research Office in the 1990s undertook a project on the administration of Mayor Edward I. Koch. In this interview, conducted by John Metzger in 1992, Deputy Mayor Kenneth Lipper explained how an incident in a movie theater not only illustrates Koch's flamboyant personal style, but can also shed light on his tremendous success as a New York City politician.
And he said, "God, let's get out and go to a movie." This is like at 10 o'clock, you know, 10 to 10 or quarter of 10 or something like that. He said, "I'm dying to see E.T. So we push our way through this crowd and get out on the sidewalk, and we get there, and there's this huge line around the theater. And we had a rule never to buck the line. It was just very bad politically to take privilege. I mean, we felt that way. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to take privilege. You don't want to be a royal person. Because people really resent that. So we had a very strict rule about not doing that. Ed was just dying to see this movie, though. And he goes along the line, shaking hands with everybody, saying, "How am I doing? How am I doing?" And we keep moving forward along this huge line till we get to the front. And then we stop at the ticket counter. Because Ed says, "We'll never get into this movie," because his line was so big. It was all sold out. Never get into this movie. So we go up to the ticket counter, and he buys tickets for both of us. We go in, we sit down in an empty theater, and then they let the people in. Everyone sits down. This woman gets up, turns around, and the lights are still on, you know. Everyone's seated, and she said, "I saw you buck the line, and I'll bet you didn't pay." And she's standing up, pointing the finger like, you know, some kind of accusing vixen. I, of course, shriveled in my seat, you know. So I shrink down. Koch stands up, you know, he's a rather big man. And she was like 10 rows ahead of us. Mm. And he stands up and he looks at her and said, "I did too pay." So she said, "Well, you got ahead of the line anyway." And as a real New Yorker, she wasn't going to take any shit from anyone. And Koch unflinchingly says to her, "You know, I've been working 2 months straight waiting to see this movie. I've been dying to see E.T., but I've been working day and night, 7 o'clock till 11 o'clock. I miss this movie every night. It's the first time I had a chance to see it." He says, "Give me a break." And she said, "You give me a break. I work too." And Koch turns around to the audience, stretches his arms out in the Christ-like position, and says, "Tell her to give me a break," in the most plaintive, sad voice, a little voice for Koch, you know? And all of a sudden the audience starts howling, "Sit down, give him a break." And he's hollering, "Give me a break," you know? And as the audience crescendo of criticism got behind him, he got louder. He started with a meek, "Give me a break," to, "Give me a break!" And so she sits down, totally humiliated.
Wow.
Everybody claps, and Koch, you know, sits down. I'm sitting there in awe of this display. And he says, "Ken, remember, the lesson is always take the offensive." And that really defines so much of his political style and all this dueling, you know, with the president.
After serving in the United States Army in Vietnam, Bobby Bowen, in 1967, joined the newly organized Black Panthers and became its Richmond, California leader. In a 1984 interview conducted by Ron Grayley, Bowen recalled the first time he read the autobiography of Malcolm X and explained the profound impact that the book had upon himself and others of his generation.
"When I got home from Vietnam, oh man, that was when I first got turned on to the Muslims, and actually not really the Muslims, when I first got turned on to Malcolm. My stepfather was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. I remember one day I walked in the house and I saw it, and I picked it up and I couldn't put it down. And when I picked it up and I started reading it, lot of things started to come clear to me.
Like what?
Well, the things that he talked about in terms of the plight and the condition of black people, I mean, it was an autobiography of his own life and development. But what was important about it, I think, and what was key to me, was that he had reasons and explanations and discussions about why black people suffered. Why were we specifically in this condition and circumstance and situation, which is something I had never covered before, never. I mean, one of the things I remember back about high school was one day in history class, I opened up a book and there was a picture of this black man, or a slave, standing next to a covered wagon. That's the only thing I remember back in those days about Africans, you know, or about slaves. Nothing, zero, blank. So when I, you know, in reading the autobiography, a lot of things just seemed to start falling, explanations that never were explained before. Never, my mother never talked to me about it, my father never talked to me about it. Nobody in my family ever talked to me about it, never read anything about it. The condition in black people was just something. It was like accepting an idea that that was the way we were supposed to be. We were supposed to be that way, so that was natural. And that all the feelings and anxieties that you had about those conditions were things that you just kept in yourself, that you just blanked out, or you denied, or you didn't accept, well, see, my mama told me that everybody's the same, everything's all right, you should treat everybody the same, and all that other shit is bullshit. And that was it, period, in a discussion. And here, you pick up a book that begins to explain point by point and in detail why people are suffering the way they do, their attitudes, their ideas, you know, this whole, the whole orientation. And, you know, it's like this light bulb comes on in your head and you say, damn, you mean this is what? It was just profound. That was the most profound experience in my life, was reading that book. From then on, I was so thirsty to know, to understand more, to be more clear. And then I also became angry. I became more angry. I became angry in terms of, you mean my life doesn't have to be this way? You mean black people don't have to live like this? You mean it could be different? You mean that white people are responsible? I became more conscious. I developed the type of consciousness I guess you would develop at that particular stage about myself and about my community and about my family, about black people. Whole different attitude, whole different attitude, whole different approach. See, the best I can say is from that, I was off and running then. I was born the day I read. That was when I was born. When I read that book, man, I was born. I was, hey man, I'll never forget that. That was the experience of my life.
Celebrated as the wittiest woman in America, Dorothy Parker was one of the brightest lights of the famous Algonquin Round Table and among the most quoted personalities of her era. In this interview, conducted by Joan Franklin in 1959 for the Popular Arts Project, Parker explained her move to Hollywood in the early 1930s and talked about the attraction of writing for the motion pictures.
Well, the years are too long, and they're very hard to say. I went out there, possibly for the reason many people get out there, because I was broke, and I thought you could make money there. The curious thing about making money in Hollywood, and you make a great, great deal of it, it is incredible the money you make of it. But it's like, I don't know, but the money is like, it's like, oh, I don't know, small ice in your hand, it all vanishes. That's all. I stayed there because you could stay there. You could have the most remarkable house. You could have a pool if you wished. I don't swim, but my goodness, you could have so many things, and you said to yourself while you were there, oh, for heaven's sake, I might as well live here as good as I can while I have to be here. I can't say it's dreadful. How dare I say I was dreadful? I was getting so much money for it, you see. No, it wasn't dreadful. It was, what can I say, except it was a terrible bore. It was the most extraneous bore. You sat there and you sat there and you sat there. That was what it was. And then somebody came in. I remember one, I'm not going to use names. One, producer we had would keep coming in with things he'd written and saying, hey, put this in, will you? And it would be a bit like, oh, my dear, it would be heaven for you and I. And also, everybody there wrote. Everybody wrote. I never saw such a thing. The nice man at the gates would write. The producer would write. That was much worse. But everybody wrote. Now, I am told it's much worse if you work in music, because everybody writes music. That must be much worse, don't you think? However, we went on through this. I will not soon forget a very elegant producer I had who said, now listen, are we extracting the milk of the theme? Well, you know, I can't do that. I'm too old. Everybody writes. My good God almighty, everybody writes. I never saw it. Everybody writes. Producer comes in with letters. The nice little boy comes in and says, hey, miss, how about this here and here? Everybody write, including me.
One of the first of its kind, the office's oral history project on the administration of President Dwight D. Eisenhower, contains more than 200 interviews. In an interview conducted by John Luter in 1971, Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus defended his record on civil rights and recounted a private meeting he had with Eisenhower in the midst of the Little Rock school desegregation crisis in 1957.
So I went in and met with the president, and he didn't know a thing about the situation. I could not comprehend, and I cannot yet, that kind of a difficulty, that his aides would keep him so uninformed. They talked all the time about the deliberate speed. So after he gave me an opportunity to say some words to him, and I mentioned this deliberate speed, I said, Mr. President, I felt that if anyone was entitled to consideration, that if anyone had approached this deliberate speed that Arkansas had in comparison to all the states with a comparable problem, because we already have more integrated public schools in Arkansas than 11 other states with a comparable problem, all of them combined didn't have as much. All of it during my administration. We had integrated all the institutions of higher learning except two, and that is the Negro College and one other down there where they didn't, the Negroes applied. We had integrated the bus systems. All the businesses had already opened their cafes and everything like this, and all was going well. And if anyone had approached this thing they termed deliberate speed, Arkansas had in comparison to the others, so I thought we were entitled to a little consideration and not just be picked out and made the goat, and to bear the butt and the burden of the whole thing. I was the first governor in the history of Arkansas to put Negroes on the Democratic Central Committee. I sat on a resolutions committee a few years before when we opened the primaries, you know, to Negroes. Did away with that all-white primary thing. My whole record had been to give them an opportunity for participation. And in this field, after the court order had been issued, Arkansas had, in this field, made more progress than any other state with a comparable problem. Maybe that's what led them to think that they could, you know, become national heroes in Little Rock.
How did it start out? How did the conversation go?
Well, at first he was going to tell me off like a general tells a lieutenant, you know. And I could see that he didn't know too much about it. They had tried to advise him what to say. Now, in the field of the military, of course, he knew his way. But as everyone knows, Eisenhower was always a bit lost in the field of civil government because he'd never had any background or training in it and never knew whether he's a Democrat or Republican until he ran for office and hadn't ever voted, I don't think. Well, after I had told him this, the old gentleman was impressed. He was fair-minded. They simply hadn't informed him on anything. He didn't know any of this. So we went back out and we visited with Mr. Adams and Mr. Hayes. Brooks Hayes confirmed all this. And I had asked him for, I said, "Now, Mr. President, I'm going to tell you that this will solve the problem. But the only hope of solving it right now without the use of force is a delay to give the tempers a chance to cool off, to give the emotions a chance to subside. And that I thought that as little as 10 days might be helpful. But certainly a semester would be better. And of course, there were others who had wanted years postponed. Of course, some of them wanted to put off forever. You know what the situation was."
One of the great classic actresses of her era, Dame Judith Anderson, rarely accepted roles in motion pictures. Interviewed in 1971 by Charles Higham for an oral history project on the Hollywood film industry, Anderson here recalls her misadventures in shooting the 1970 film A Man Called Horse.
Well, now you take Man Called Horse, which I didn't want to talk about because it was a disaster for me. I did not have my way about that at all. Now, here was the matriarch of the tribe, an old harridan, rough, rowdy, humorous old girl, but she was a matriarch. She was the mother of the chief of the tribe, but I was directed to always shout and scream and yell and carry on like a very ordinary person. There were times when I agreed that she was ridiculous and when she was carrying on with her horse, Shankarbhat Khan. But I was not allowed my clean line of thought and feeling, the rhythm of Cowhead, Buffalo Cowhead. I was not permitted to do what I wanted to do.
Did you have to master, was it Sue?
Sue, yes. Oh, yes, it was all in Sue.
Now, was that difficult to master?
Well, just learn phonetically. Yeah. Learn. We had a teacher learn the words. But it was a disastrous picture for me because they discovered after being on it for a couple of weeks I had blue eyes, and there's no blue-eyed Sue, so I had to wear contact lenses, and I stupidly agreed to wearing them. And I was finally, after awful goings-on in Durango and Sears Roebuck to get contact lenses, went to Mexico City to get them, came back, had them put in, and they hurt too terribly, and I just couldn't tolerate them. So I went back into Mexico City, and they discovered that the lens were faulty. They were scratching my eyes. So I said, no more of that. And then the last day on work down there, I fell and hurt my back seriously, and I was hospitalized for 5 days with that, because the camera should have been sunk, and it was a close-up of the death scene, which had been played in long, but this was the close-up, and I had to crouch down. But I was built up on apple boxes that were a little insecure, and then to move off camera, I fell into a bunch of jagged rocks about 5 or 6 times, and I suppose I tensed my back. So when I came back, they wanted me to do, I don't know, 12 or 15 or 16 more close-ups. I had no close-ups at all because I couldn't use the contact lenses. And my back was still too bad to do any more work, and I just couldn't wear the lenses, so I had very few close-ups, and I didn't even finish the picture. Somebody else finished, but not much, but just a gesture or something in the snow, but I've not seen it, and I'm not going to see it. And somebody else dubbed my voice when the dubbing was necessary, so I can't have much feeling about Buffalo Cowhead in A Man Called Horse. Oh, and added to that, Richard Harris had my best scene taken out of the picture, wouldn't let me shoot it.
In an illustrious political career that spanned 4 decades, Abraham A. Ribicoff of Connecticut served as a judge, state representative, congressman, governor, cabinet member, and 3-term United States senator. Today, Ribicoff is best remembered for the impassioned speech he delivered at the 1968 Democratic Party convention in Chicago, a speech in which he condemned police assaults on protesters outside the convention center. In the following excerpt from an oral history interview conducted by Ron Grayley in 1993, Ribicoff described the events that led up to his impromptu speech and convention delegates' responses to it.
As I understand it, you threw away your speech.
Oh, yeah, I threw away the speech. What happened there, I was at the Chicago convention not as a delegate. Uh-huh. I decided that I would be for McGovern. Uh-huh. In order to make the speech, I had to be a delegate. Uh-huh. And Don Irwin, who was a congressman from the 4th District, gave me his seat for the purpose of making the speech. And the McGovern headquarters were at the Blackstone Hotel, which is right across the street from the Hilton, where everybody's headquarters were, and all the action taking place on Michigan Boulevard. And looking out, I saw the tumult, and I saw some of the kids that were coming back who were working McGovern, all bloodied up when they were hit by the club. Now, then I went down and sat in the trailer waiting for the McGovern presentation. And in every one of these big trailers, that there were television sets, and I was watching what was going on. But Wayne Granquist, who was my administrative assistant, was with me then. He said, gee, he just talked to his mother in New Britain. And she told him about the terrible things that were going on, and she watched television. So Wayne and I watched television. Frank Mankiewicz was in there watching with me. He was the second denomination. And I saw this tumult and all these things, and I thought this was terrible what was going on. I said to Frank, I said, you know, I've got this speech, if the press has got it, but I don't think that's the issue here. I don't think that I want to give this speech. I said, I want to talk about what the hell is going on here. I think it's wrong. It's Gestapo tactics. I mean, these kids beaten up. I mean, whether you agree with them or not, you just don't keep beating them up with clubs. And he said, look, Abe, he said, what the hell if that's what you feel like doing? He said, go up and say what's in your heart. So I did, you know, the press had my speech. It was on a teleprompter and everything else. So I just went up there and I winged it. And the best speeches I've ever made are speeches that have been made spontaneously like that, when you just what's in you. So then I went up there, and no one anticipated, who the hell knew that I was going to give that speech, you know? Basically, I was part of the regular Democratic organizations all these years and everything else. And Connecticut was, the Connecticut delegation, they were all for Humphrey, you know?
What was going through your mind when you were giving the speech and Daley was sitting right in front of you, screaming?
Well, you know, most people missed the fact.
You could read his lips.
Yeah, well, that's how I knew, because there were lip readers.
Uh-huh.
You goddamn fin-Jew bastard, you know. But the pandemonium broke loose. Then there were a lot of the pro things were hollering, and the anti were hollering, and the convention was just one mass of confusion. And there was Daley, but there was John Conley, who was chairman of the Texas delegation. And he was just as bitter, but everybody was on Daley, but I was seeing Conley too. I said, that's the Conley was just as vicious and just as bad as waving his arms at me. And my adrenaline was pumping pretty good, and I was saying what was in my heart and mind, and of course I figured that's the things that you do spontaneously are always the best. Now the irony of it was, I would say, I was then isolated by the whole Connecticut delegation. The delegation would walk across the street not to say hello to me, you know. Yeah, I was all by myself.
In the 1970s, Bluma Sverdlov conducted 13 interviews documenting the history of the psychoanalytic movement. One of those interviewed was American analyst Muriel Gardner, who had moved to Vienna in the 1930s to continue her studies. In Vienna, she became involved with the Austrian Socialist Party and helped rescue dozens of socialists and Jews after the Nazi takeover of Austria. Here, she recalls the evening in 1938 when the Nazis marched into the city.
I had just been putting Connie to bed when Schuschnigg made this announcement, so I did not hear it. I'd been listening to the radio every few minutes all day, but I didn't hear this. But just after I left Connie, I had a telephone call from Bertha Bornstein, the analyst,
who was really my best friend among the analysts. And actually, Connie had been sick. She'd had a very bad cold, and Berta knew this. And Berta said on the telephone, "Muriel, I'm so worried about Connie. Why don't you take her off to Switzerland, to the mountains? The change of air would do her good." And I said, "Well, I don't think it's that urgent." And she said, "Oh, indeed it is. I'm sure she'll get pneumonia if you don't." Well, I realized that this was a political warning. Mm-hmm. And I ran to turn on the window. I heard noise and I looked down and the whole street was full of people with their Nazi flags, their swastika flags, and singing the Nazi song. And I don't know how, within 10 minutes, so many thousands of Nazis and Nazi sympathizers were there, but they were. Well, Joe had gone early in the morning to Czechoslovakia to confer with Otto Bauer, and he was supposed to return around 7 or 8 or 9 in the evening. I didn't know exactly when. And we were very cautious about not keeping any illegal literature around. But in this crucial time, it had been impossible not to. I mean, Joe had written some things that we wanted to give to some of the comrades. There were various things. And I had them in this apartment. And I thought the first thing I have to do is get rid of it. Now, there was no stove or fireplace in this modern apartment. And I began to tear it into tiny bits and put it down the toilet. And very soon the toilet was stuffed up and making a horrible hissing noise, which I couldn't stop and I was afraid would be heard. And I finally got up on a chair to reach the tank, and I remember I was able to put in an inverted flower pot to hold up the lever or whatever you do. I'm not a mechanic or a plumber in any sense of the word, but I finally stopped the noise, but of course I couldn't destroy the rest of the literature. And I had meanwhile, after Berta's call, although it was intended as a political warning, I began to think more seriously about whether I shouldn't get Connie out of the country. She was just short of 7 years old, and I had really never thought of sending her before I went, but I realized that in this situation, I would really be in danger. Also, I realized I was going to be very, very busy and have to expose myself much more than I had done before.
The publisher of an anarchist journal in Bologna, Italy, Aldino Feliciani, worked fervently to build international support for Sacco and Vanzetti. After their controversial conviction for the murder of a Massachusetts paymaster and guard. Interviewed by Dean Albertson, Feliciani described his last meeting with the two men, a meeting that took place shortly before their execution in August of 1927.
I was the one who brought the news to Sacco Vanzetti in the death cell that they had to die August 10th, then was postponed, August 27th. In the meantime, Fuller had seen the boy in jail, went to see them, previous to the decision, or while the Gloral Committee was working. And I went there, and I learned from Manzetti and Sacco that he was there visiting them. Corsacco, as you can surmise, refused to shake hands with Fuller. He didn't want any part of it. He was representative of the capitalist class. He was the downtrodden. He don't have anything to ask him. He don't want any grace. He don't want anything, any part of it. So he refused to talk. Vanzetti being tight, the gentle type, and sure, he sat down on them. The next morning, I went down to see them. And Vanzetti told me, this man will never send off to the chair. He sat down here and talked to me like a brother. Smiling, joking. That man will never send off to the chair. And I try to disarm Vanzetti, to destroy Vanzetti, the enthusiasm, because I sense that the worst was coming, in my estimation. So why have a man eluded himself to be in paradise when actually was in hell?
Helen Suzman was a lone voice of liberalism in the South African Parliament for almost 20 years. Interviewed by Ed Edwin in 1984, she describes her first meeting with Nelson Mandela while he was a prisoner on Robben Island.
Atleta was smuggled out of jail to me, and I immediately sent a copy of it to the commanding officer, demanding that steps be taken against this man who was making false accusations against me. And I never heard another word. Anyway, thereafter, I started making regular visits to jails. And I was appalled when I first went to Robben Island, which was about 1965, somewhere around there, to find, the first time I'd met Nelson Mandela was when he was in jail on Robben Island. And I arrived, I was taken to what are known as the single cell section, which housed about 30 men, most of them on long-term sentences for crimes against the state, sabotage, treason, etc., and several of them life imprisonment. And as I walked in and stopped at the first cell and said, "Good morning, I'm Helen Suzman," the man said, "Yes, we know who you are. Don't waste time talking to us, go and talk to Nelson, he's our leader." And I went straight up to Nelson Mandela. He was in a single, they each were in single cells. And he stuck his hand through the bar and said, "How do you do, Mrs. Suzman? I'm very pleased to meet you." And I said, "How do you do, Mr. Mandela? How are you and how are things here?" And he said, "They are very bad indeed. I'm very glad you came to see us." And although he was standing right next to me, he told all. I mean, he's a very tall, he's got a very good stance, and speaks a very good English. He's an educated man, a lawyer. And he made no bones about it. He's got an air of authority about him. He made no bones about his complaints. He said, "There is a man here in charge of us who is a Nazi. And indeed, he has got a swastika tattooed on the back of his hand. And he said to us when we came, those are my, pointing to the swastika, those are my political views, and you will suffer for it, you communists." And he said, "We have a bad time, Mrs. Suzman. That man drives us to work." They, at that stage, they were working, digging lime out of a pit, you know, sand pit. He said, "They drive us to work with dogs, this man. He makes us run to work with the dog at our heels. And he's a very tough man indeed." I said, "I'll certainly take this up when I get back to the mainland with the Minister of Justice."
Today, the Oral History Research Office continues to sponsor and assist projects that document the unwritten history of the 20th century. Among these are Ronald Baer and Gerald Oppenheimer's ongoing oral history interviews on physicians' responses to the AIDS epidemic. A medical student, when AIDS first appeared in San Francisco in the early 1980s, Joseph O'Neill would become one of the nation's first doctors to specialize in AIDS treatment. In the following excerpt from his 1995 interview, O'Neill recalls the case that changed his life.
"You know, what do you do when you can't fix the problem? Where does really being a doctor, to me, really begins almost, is at those points. I remember I was on call and we were sitting in the cafeteria at San Francisco General Hospital on this fourth year rotation. And I was up for the next admission. The resident comes up with this chart about, you know, 4 inches thick and says, "Joe, you can turn this one down because he said you've got the last three admissions you've got are AIDS patients." And he said, "This is another AIDS patient that's coming in. You're up for it, but I'll give it to the intern because you need something different." Yeah, I remember saying, "I really don't want another one." So he put the chart down in front of me, and I said, "Not to do it." And on the front of the chart was his name and birth date. And it was his birthday was March 9th, which is my birthday. And I looked at that thing, I saw we had the same birthday. And I thought, I have to take this guy as my patient. This is, like, I have to do this. So I said, "No, I'll take him, you know." You sure? Yeah, I'm sure. Since we have the same birthday, how can I not take him? Mm-hmm. And they warned me, said his parents are a real problem. His family is awful. He's dying, so he's, really gone. But his family is just awful. And he had, he was very sick, he was wasted, cachectic, fever. I mean, he probably had MAC disease that if we had known it, we would have tripped, but we didn't know what the hell it was, and we're culturing for it, and, renal. I mean, he was just, he was paraplegic, and just awful. Pain, just, all that kind of stuff. And his parents they're from Florida. He's a gay man living in San Francisco. Parents lived in Florida. They came out in total denial of what was going on. They loved this guy, their son, passionately. All they wanted to do was to fix everything. And they wanted the best doctors and the best that money could buy. I mean, very controlling. He wanted chocolate pudding and they sent peach pudding and, I'm going to call the head of the hospital. It's just creating this stuff, And they were very hard to deal with. And here I am, this medical student, sort of at this time working with a resident who wasn't even paying that much attention to him because he was no longer kind of an interesting case. And at the same time, all these consultants were, the neurologist and the nephrologist and the da-da-da-da-da, all this stuff was going on. And everybody wanting, get this scan, do this thing, get this 24-hour urine and do these. I mean, it's kind of like knee-jerk, kind of like do this test, do that. And meanwhile, here's this like skinny, dying young man who's like worrying about the flavor of his pudding and his, it was just, the whole thing was wrong. And so I still remember this. This is where I really learned something about doctoring from him. I went into round in the morning and he was started kicking into the stuff, and then he, and I was just sort of talking with him and sort of listening to him heart and, kind of talk. And he looked at me and said, "Am I going to die?" And I said, "Yes, you are going to die." And he said, "When?" And I said, "Very soon." And he said, "Oh." He said, "Do my parents know?" And I said, "I think they do." But I said, "Have you talked with them about it?" And he said, "No, I couldn't talk with them about it." He said, "It's too hard. I can't talk with them about it." And I said, "When your parents get here today, you have the nurse page me, and I want to come." And about an hour later, we were rounding, I got paged by the nurse. So I split off from rounds, and I came back down. And I sort of walked in the room, and they were, just doing all this stuff. And the whole time, this has been going on for 3 weeks, I've been taking care of him. I had never seen one of his parents touch him, lay hands on him. I mean, they did everything, but they would, they couldn't assist no one. I remember there was like fixing the blinds in the room and his mother. They were very nice people, really wonderful people. They were just suffering horribly. And I went after him and I brought in chairs, these like, folding chairs, and I set up chairs around his bed. And I said, "Stop it." And it was just me. I mean, there was no nurse, no one else. It was just me, this little medical student, And I said, "I want to sit down." And I said, "We have something very important to discuss here." And so they sat there and they said, "What is it?" I said, "What we have to discuss is the fact that Jay is dying." And I said, I just want you to talk about it. I said, "I'll leave the room if you want, but this is what's happening. There's nothing more we're going to do. Jay is dying, and you really need to spend some time with him." And I remember his parents, they started crying, and they got up and they held him. And in 3 weeks, they had never touched him. And I left them. I mean, that's what I saw, and I left them, I said, "You have to say goodbye and spend, it doesn't matter what he's eating, it matters that you spend some time together." I was on call that night. Maybe 2 hours after they left, he died. He lost consciousness, became delirious, and was dead the next morning. And I learned something incredibly important about practicing medicine. because all the technical stuff that we were doing, here we are, you know, the San Francisco General, UC San Francisco, I mean, all that kind of stuff. I made a huge difference in that family's experience of AIDS and of their son's death and of his death, you know? I mean, he, in retrospect, he was holding on. He could die after, you know, after that happened. And to me, being able to cure him would have been wonderful, but that wasn't going to happen. That isn't happening now. And I realized I was a good doctor to that patient.
So why don't you run yourself? You're always so critical of everybody else. Why don't you run for office? I said, you know, you have an idea. It's not a bad idea. And so I then went to Martinique, and I remember this like yesterday. I was doing deep sea diving. There is no experience like deep sea diving. It is a sound and it is a world different from anything you've ever experienced. There's no interference, there's no conflict. You're just there with yourself, intensely. And it was down there that I said to myself, well, God damn it, I think it's overdue. I will run.
I just thought you got up and danced. It was the same as it was on the stage. When I went out there and I finally got into my first movie, which was a musical eventually, called For Me and My Gal with Judy Garland and produced by Arthur Freed, of whom we spoke earlier, I found out the dancing was different when you did it on the screen. It wasn't the same as when you did it on the stage. So I began to inquire around and ask people, and nobody seemed to know why or wherefore.
No, I think. He was a municipal court judge, too. His name was Wells, Fred Wells. And he said, there's a man I know, I think very highly of. His name is Hoover. He's an engineer. Come and meet him at dinner. And I met this young man, if it was as early as I think it was Hoover, who's quite a bit younger than I am, and he was a very impressive person. There's no denying that. He was very sure of himself. He had no misgivings, and he announced things categorically. It was all more or less from Olympus, but he was very, very impressive.
Well, but in 1913, I was appointed by the National American Woman Suffrage Association, which was the old organization of Susan B. Anthony and everybody else, the only one in the country. I was asked to come down, to go down to Washington and take over the chairmanship of their congressional committee, which was to put through this amendment that Miss Anthony had helped draw up. And Lucy Burns
had asked to go with me. Happy was William Faulkner, the great American novelist. I was with him coming home from a party in Brooklyn once, somewhere in Brooklyn Heights. We went to some literary party. We came home in the subway, and Bill's feet hurt, so we took his shoes off. And when we got to get off at 59th Street, he couldn't find one shoe. And I still remember a picture of great William Faulkner crawling on all fours the length of the subway car. Okay. He found his shoe, it had been kicked right out of the other end of the car. It was late at night, only about 10 people. But there was Mr. Faulkner crawling on all fours and finding his shoe.
When we sent it once down, we did. At the time, I was skeptical, I must admit, because the weather was bad. As it turned out, it was a blessing because the German air could not pick us up coming across it. But at the time, the waves were so high that I was afraid that we would have trouble getting ashore. In fact, we did lose our floating tanks, which we counted a great deal on because the waves were too high for them. But that was more than offset by the fact that we were able to obtain a considerable surprise.
10, 15 times a day. Oh, Mayor, you have to let walk around. You must run again. And my phrase, which was instinctive, no, with a very tough no, no. People threw me out, and now the people must be punished. And everybody would just laugh, and sometimes would respond saying, but Mayor, we've been punished.
And one of their favorite songs was that one about the we shall not be moved. I've heard it now sung by unions and political parties, and by one of life's ironies, I heard the Progressive Party using a version of it.
The Union is our leader, we shall not be moved. The Union is our leader, we shall not be moved, just like a tree planted by the